Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
On our podcast, Good Bad Billionaire, we tell the stories of billionaires and how they made their money.
Then we decide if they're good or bad.
Our latest episode is on cocaine kingpin El Chapo.
One of the biggest drug lords in history.
He's claimed personal responsibility for 2,000 murders.
Not to mention decades of violence and addiction.
After multiple escapes, he's finally locked up for life.
So, is he good or bad?
Listen to Good Bad Billionaire to find out. Nailbiter.
I mean, he's bad, right?
Yeah, but listen anyway. It's an incredible story.
Unmissable stories from around the globe from the BBC World Service.
My happy place, this is who I am.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 17th of January, these are our main stories. The US National Security Advisor says Washington is seeking to de-escalate tensions in the Middle East, despite its recent actions against Houthi militants. But Jake Sullivan says the course of the conflict depends on Iran. Pakistan has angrily condemned Iran for carrying out what it said was a deadly missile strike in Balochistan. Iran said it had attacked separatist militants. And two deputy chairmen of Britain's ruling Conservative Party have resigned for defying the government and voting for changes to its controversial immigration bill. Also in this podcast...
Researchers created 113 cloned embryos, 11 of which were implanted in surrogate animals, one of which led to a healthy offspring.
Scientists in China say a cloned monkey has lived healthily for 2 years, defying the short-lived fate of other cloned primates. But we start in the Middle East, where the US is seeking a de-escalation in rising tensions in the region. That's according to President Biden's National Security Advisor, despite the country's strikes on Houthi rebels based in Yemen. Jake Sullivan made the comments at the annual economic gathering in Davos in Switzerland.
We are not looking for regional conflict. Far from it. Through a combination of steady deterrence and steadfast diplomacy, we seek to stop the spread of conflict and to create the conditions for de-escalation. Our approach is and remains focused on moving towards greater integration and stability in the region.
Well, the missile strikes by the US military are in response to Houthi attacks on international commercial shipping in the Red Sea. The latest attack by the Houthi rebels caused what was described as material but minor damage to a Greek-owned vessel when it was hit near the Yemeni port of Salif. Also speaking in Davos, the Prime Minister of Qatar, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, said the US-led military strikes in Yemen won't contain the attacks.
This is also will create a high risk of further escalation and further expansion of that. We always prefer diplomacy over any military resolutions, and we believe that we shouldn't just focus on those small conflicts. We should focus on the main conflict in Gaza. And as soon as it's diffused, I believe everything else will be diffused.
So that's the view of the Qatari government. Before that, the US government. I got more from our correspondent, Hugo Bachega, who's following events from Beirut.
The Houthis are saying that these attacks are going to continue. They say that this wave of attacks targeting these commercial ships in the Red Sea are in protest at what's happening in Gaza, the Israeli war against Hamas. And they say that these attacks will continue unless there is a ceasefire in Gaza. And I think earlier we saw that another ship was hit by a missile near Yemen, thought to have been fired by the Houthis. There was no significant damage. There were no injuries. But it shows that the Houthis continue to have the ability to carry out these attacks despite these airstrikes that have been carried out by the Americans, by the British, targeting Houthi positions in Yemen.
Isn't that one view that it would appear that the American and initially British military attempts to degrade the Houthis' capabilities don't seem to be working?
Well, I think that was the question from the start. You know, what is the plan? And the Americans and the British have said that the goal here is to guarantee freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. We've seen that those attacks by the Houthis have caused a major economic disruption, major disruption to international trade. You know, there was a rise in oil prices and all the rest. So they said that this was to prevent, you know, a major economic impact from those attacks. But we saw that after the first wave of the attacks, American officials said that only between 20 to 30% of the infrastructure being used by the Houthis in those attacks had been damaged or destroyed. In other words, it means that the Houthis still have the weapons, still have the positions, everything they need to carry out those attacks. These attacks have continued, and I think there were questions over whether there would be another wave of attacks, especially from the Americans, and I think this is exactly what has happened.
Hugo Bachega reporting from Beirut. Well, let's stay in the city because Lebanon's economy has been hit hard by the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. The country is heavily reliant on tourism and hospitality, but few people are visiting at the moment and thousands of Lebanese people have been displaced by the fighting on the border between Lebanon and Israel. From Beirut again, Hannah McCarthy reports.
Israel says it is at war with Palestinian militants who've launched the biggest attack on its territory in years. The total number of dead has reached more than 300. Hamas says it has...
When the war between Israel and Hamas began on the 7th of October, it quickly spread to southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah, an Iran-backed ally of Hamas, began exchanging fire with Israeli forces along the blue line that separates the two countries.
The war is happening in Gaza, but it's also happening in Lebanon. This is something sometimes people forget or is not very covered in the news.
Joseph Saej had only just opened Levant, a store specializing in Lebanese baked goods in Beirut a few weeks before the war began.
I lived 10 years in Paris and I got back to Beirut 6 months ago.
Since October, tens of thousands of people have fled their homes in southern Lebanon. And many countries have advised their citizens against travelling to Lebanon, with several airlines cutting their flights to Beirut.
All the foreigners that were in Beirut, be it the tourists or the ones who were living here, expats or volunteers with NGOs, they left within days.
The lack of flights and foreign visitors hit vital tourist revenues, says Sami Zugab, an economist at the Policy Initiative in Beirut.
If we had assumed a tourist revenue similar to what we had last year, for example, of around $1,500 per passenger, we're looking at something closer to around $300 million in losses, only from the tourist revenues.
He says that fewer flights and visitors have also reduced the flow of foreign currency into Lebanon, which has a cash-based economy after its banking sector collapsed.
Lebanon also imports cash, and much of this cash that was being shipped through the airport.
During the first month of the war, the Lebanese restaurant sector experienced an 80% drop in business, hitting owners like Joseph Saej hard.
Sales went down. Coming back here, I knew that at some point, eventually something would happen. I didn't expect that it would be that big and it would be that quick.
The holiday season drew some Lebanese expats back from abroad, bringing with them fresh dollars and euros. I spoke to Danny Boumaroun, a Lebanese-American music producer, about how the holiday season had felt in Beirut this year.
Things are starting to feel a bit normal. Beirut is pretty busy, but not nearly as much as usual. This year it feels off. Obviously, things are uncertain and no one knows what's going to happen.
Maya Noon from the syndicate that represents restaurant owners in Lebanon says that the hospitality sector is determined to keep its doors open.
The restaurant sector has always been one of these sectors that were like really behind the economy in Lebanon.
She says they'll keep operating as the Hamas-Israel war continues with no end in sight.
Hannah McCarthy reporting. Now, Pakistan has strongly condemned an Iranian airstrike on its territory, calling it completely unacceptable and warning of serious consequences. It summoned the Iranian chargé d'affaires and lodged a protest as well at the foreign ministry in Tehran. Islamabad said two children had been killed in the attack. Our correspondent in Pakistan, Caroline Davis, has more.
We've had this confirmation now from the foreign ministry here in Pakistan. Now, they have said that this is a very serious breach of their airspace. They are talking about the fact that this will have serious consequences. Now, this is an explosion that has happened in the area of Balochistan. That is one of the provinces in southwest Pakistan. It's Pakistan's largest province, least populated, and borders Iran. Now, according to Iranian state media, there was a report earlier saying that Iran had attacked militants using missiles and a drone strike. And they said that this had happened in this area. Now, at the moment, we have seen that those reports, according to the news agency AFP, have since been removed. But we've also now, of course, had this confirmation from Pakistan. They have said that there has been the death so far of 2 children and 3 injured in what it's referring to as a violation of its airspace. Now, quite crucially, to follow this story in the course of the next few hours and days, we have also heard from them that they have said that this is unacceptable and can have serious consequences. And they say that those consequences will lie squarely with Iran.
Caroline Davis. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned Western nations they may face Russian aggression themselves if they don't help Ukraine to win the war. Speaking at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos, Mr. Zelensky appealed for more support.
If anyone thinks this is only about us, this is only about Ukraine, they are fundamentally mistaken. Possible directions and even timeline of a new Russian aggression beyond Ukraine become more and more obvious.
Mr. Zelensky also warned against any attempt to freeze the conflict, describing the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, as a predator who would never be satisfied. Speaking separately in Moscow, Mr. Putin said Russia now had the initiative in the war and Ukraine's statehood could be irreparably damaged if it continued. Let's go to the United States now and the presidential election due there later this year, because the favourite for the Republican nomination, Donald Trump, appeared in a New York court on Tuesday, only hours after he swept the Iowa caucuses to cement his position as the frontrunner to become the Republican candidate in November's election. The trial is a civil case. The writer, E. Jean Carroll, is seeking more than $10 million in defamation damages. Last year, in a separate civil case, a court found that Mr. Trump was liable for sexually assaulting E. Jean Carroll. So it's been a very busy 24 hours for Donald Trump. He's already moved his electoral operations to the next state that will make its choice in the nomination process. That's New Hampshire, where a big rally is scheduled to take place. I spoke to our correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, who's in the US, and I asked him, with all the other material on his plate, did Mr. Trump have to appear in that New York court on Tuesday?
I think he's found that in some ways showing up has a sort of political upside as well. It does tend to raise money for him. He always sends out an accompanying campaign fundraising email at the same time, and it does bring in dollars. And I think keeping these sort of illegal problems in the spotlight for him, and whilst he would prefer not to have them, they do keep his base motivated as well. So there are some upsides to facing all these various cases around the country.
There's no doubt, is there, that Iowa was a crushing victory for him?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at any kind of election where you've got multiple candidates and someone wins by 30 points, I mean, that is an astonishing number. It breaks all sorts of record. When you dig into the data, he's also winning in pretty much every demographic group. He's winning among men, women. He's winning among the everyone over 30, effectively. He's winning not just among non-college educated, which is a big measure here in the United States of voting intention, but also college educated, which is where he struggled before. You know, so he's really cleaning up at the moment. And still, there are people hanging on in the race like Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis as we move on to New Hampshire next week.
Well, let's talk just very quickly about those two. I know they do things slightly differently in New Hampshire. It's a primary, I think, isn't it, and not a caucus. But is there any way that Donald Trump is likely to face some serious opposition from either of those two?
Much narrower gap between Donald Trump and Nikki Haley there. The averages have it at about 14 points. Crucially, independent voters can vote in that primary. They tend to be more moderate, and more moderate people tend to support Nikki Haley. So she thinks it's now a two-horse race, and she says she is the last best chance to stop what she now calls, not the Biden nightmare, but the Trump-Biden nightmare. And she's publishing advertising campaigns, having a go at Trump, equivalent, you know, making an equivalence between Trump and Biden, which is absolutely a new kind of tactic and a new willingness to take on Trump directly.
Gary O'Donoghue on the election trail in the US. Scientists in China say a cloned monkey has lived for 2 years, something they managed to achieve by tweaking the process used to create Dolly the sheep, the first animal to be successfully cloned. Previous attempts to clone primates have not led to live births, or they would see the animal only live for a few hours. Well, our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh has more.
This is not the first monkey to be cloned, but it's the first rhesus monkey. The species is used in medical research because its physiology is relatively similar to those of humans and so can be used to test new drugs. The reason for creating clone monkeys is that they'd be genetically identical, meaning that there'd be less variation in tests carried out on different animals, and so experimental results would be more consistent. Researchers created 113 cloned embryos, 11 of which were implanted in surrogate animals, one of which led to a healthy offspring named Retro, who's now more than 2 years old.
Pallab Ghosh reporting, and in response to some criticisms, the Chinese scientists say that all ethical approvals have been obtained for their research. Still to come in this podcast.
I think it is going to be interesting to see whether novices can possibly tell the difference between the lab-grown and the natural diamond.
But is it true the price of diamonds is falling?
This is the story of the charismatic Nigerian preacher TB Joshua. Some called him a miracle worker.
He healed the sick, the lame walked.
A great man of God.
Others say they knew a very different man.
He's not this holy man.
What happened to me and to others shouldn't happen to any human being.
This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 2, The Disciples. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
On our podcast, Good Bad Billionaire, we tell the stories of billionaires and how they made their money.
Then we decide if they're good or bad.
Our latest episode is on cocaine kingpin El Chapo.
One of the biggest drug lords in history.
He's claimed personal responsibility for 2,000 murders.
Not to mention decades of violence and addiction.
After multiple escapes, he's finally locked up for life.
So, is he good or bad?
Listen to Good Bad Billionaire to find out, Nailbiter.
I mean, he's bad, right?
Yeah, but listen anyway. It's an incredible story.
Hello again and welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The collapse of the Islamic State group in Syria left thousands of women and children from several countries stranded in detention camps across the north. Many want to return to their countries of origin, but some governments are reluctant. Kyrgyzstan is one of the exceptions, though. In the last year, the mountainous Central Asian country has repatriated more than 100 mothers and more than 200 children. The United Nations says many of the women were often tricked or lured into going to Syria in the first place. Daniel Wittenberg travelled to a reception centre in Kyrgyzstan to hear from some of the women who did make it home.
In the mountains of northern Kyrgyzstan, a teacher is addressing a classroom of 20 women. He's standing in front of a whiteboard, but this isn't a regular lesson. It's a compulsory course in a rehabilitation program for women who have been brought back from detention camps in Syria after years living under IS rule, many say against their will. These women and their children will spend 6 weeks at a center closely monitored by Kyrgyz security services. Guards in camouflage are stationed in the hallways. Here, they eat, sleep, study religious tolerance, and receive psychological support for their trauma. At 57, Fatima is the eldest of the arrivals. We've changed her name for her safety. Fatima claims she and her children followed her husband to Turkey for work, but ended up being taken to Syria. She says she didn't realise she was in a war zone until she heard fighter jets overhead. Fatima hopes that her surviving daughter and four grandchildren, also repatriated to Kyrgyzstan, have a better future.
Well, I'm already a pensioner, but I'm glad my grandchildren can have an education. I want them to study science, to understand the world better. They've seen so little.
After they leave the center, the women face a new challenge, reintegrating into their communities. In a town outside the capital, Bishkek, we meet Elmira, also not her real name. She's in the kitchen with her mother and her 9-year-old daughter, who struts cheekily in and out of our interview. Elmira claims she was tricked into travelling to Syria 4 days after her 18th birthday by a man she fell in love with online. She's been back at home for a few months and is worried about the public reaction to women in her position.
It isn't pleasant. A lot of us don't understand why they're afraid of us. We are afraid of them. People think we have come back here with machine guns and suicide belts. It's not like that. We are people just like they are. We also have families, and we also want to live peaceful and happy lives.
Many people in Kyrgyzstan are worried about extremism, especially after the Taliban regained control of Afghanistan. These women were fearful.
They got used to the ISIS way of life. They could commit terrorist acts, like bombings.
Personally, I think that not everyone who has been to Syria is dangerous. But some people, they will have got used to the mentality of ISIS, and they might try to radicalize people here.
Despite these concerns from a mostly Muslim population, we asked the Deputy Prime Minister, Adil Bayzalov, why the government has adopted a more open policy of rehabilitation than some Western countries.
You know, it wasn't an easy decision. And of course, our kind of Islam is not radical. We are a small nation that needs to take care of each other, even of those who commit mistakes.
Most of the women do still face an investigation into their time spent under ISIS. But unlike the nearly 50,000 people who remain in Syrian camps, they have the opportunity of a second chance at life back home.
Daniel Wittenberg reporting. We're going to go to Kenya now, where authorities are to tighten rules on rented accommodation. It comes after two women were murdered in apartments in the last 2 weeks. According to a local police report, one of those women was dismembered and her remains were stuffed into a plastic bag. Now, many Kenyans have taken to social media to speak out against what they say is a deep-rooted culture of misogyny in the country. But Will Ross, our Africa editor, told me the story has also sparked an opposite reaction.
This is a phenomenon, really, that's come up on social media, where people are saying that instead of blaming the attacker, the murderer, they're kind of blaming the women. And in these two cases, they're suggesting that the women went to meet the men in these flats because they were after money. And they're then saying that it's their fault for falling into a trap. It's their fault for having loose morals. They're using that kind of language. And there's been a lot of arguing back and forth. And Amnesty International's executive director, Irungu Houghton, has also been speaking about this phenomenon. And he said that these comments online were not simply isolated cases of misogynistic men, but were indicative of a broader culture of woman hating.
There do seem to be some statistics as well that reveal the extent of a much broader problem in Kenyan society about physical violence aimed at women. I mean, some of these figures are quite breathtaking, aren't they?
They are. There was a survey done last year which said just over a third of women who responded said they had experienced physical violence. That was a survey last year. And I'm sure it's far worse than any police statistics would ever throw up, because so many women and girls would be too scared to report anything.
Well, we've got a kind of an administrative solution to these, I mean, awful, violent killings in terms of identification when it comes to hiring these apartments. But what about other proposals going forward to try to end this kind of violence aimed at women?
Well, there's a Kenyan government-run entity called the Private Security Regulator, and it's put out a statement ordering all providers of accommodation, and it requires them to hold on to identification documents, whether that's a driving licence, an ID card or a passport, to hold on to those documents of all the guests until they check out. But it's hard to see how they would be able to really police that, because I think in many cases the people renting out the flat don't even meet the people who are lodging there. And there are also calls for all cars that are going in and out of these areas where the flats are to be recorded. But who would do that? These apartment blocks often have a security company that are nothing to do with the person that's renting out the flat. And also calls for all security cameras to be checked that they're working better.
Will Ross reporting. Here in the UK, two of the deputy chairmen of Britain's governing Conservative Party have resigned after they backed amendments that sought to change a controversial new law allowing the deportation of asylum seekers to Rwanda. Lee Anderson and Brendan Clark-Smith felt that the proposed legislation wasn't tough enough. Our political editor Chris Mason explains.
They make the point, and this is one we've heard from a good number of Conservative backbenchers this afternoon, that the government's had two previous attempts to make a new law work as far as the Rwanda plan is concerned, and they have failed. And in the view of these two now former deputy chairmen, they want to be able to back the changes that they think toughen up the government's plans, because they think that would give it a greater chance of success. That's something that government ministers would dispute.
Chris Mason, well, staying here in the UK, and the story that's been dominating the news in this country for the past few weeks has concerned the post office and how hundreds of people that worked for it have been wrongly convicted of fraud or theft. And it all happened because of a faulty computer software system. Some of those caught up in the national scandal even took their own lives. The global IT firm Fujitsu, which made the software, has been coming under intense pressure, and now its chief executive has apologised. The BBC found Takehito Tokita and spoke to him at the annual economic forum in Davos.
Would you like to apologise?
Yes, of course. Fujitsu has apologised, devastating the impact on the post-mercer's lives and that of their families.
What do you think about Fujitsu giving the money back? The government suggested that you should return the money.
Please understand and ongoing and public inquiry. I'm sorry, I cannot comment.
So an apology, but no details on the money from Fujitsu's chief executive. Well, answering questions from members of parliament here in London, Fujitsu's boss in Europe, Paul Patterson, actually went further.
The inquiry is dealing with some very complex matters over...
Is there a moral obligation, Mr. Patterson, for you to contribute?
I think there is a moral obligation for the company to contribute, and I think the right place to determine that is when our responsibility is very clear. There are many parties involved in this travesty.
Well, having heard all of that, I asked our political correspondent Rob Watson if there was significance in these two comments, or were they just window dressing?
No, I think there is significance in that, Robin, because the government is estimating that this is going to cost in compensation perhaps over $1 billion. And obviously that money has got to come from somewhere. And I think the government is thinking some of it should come from the post office and another big chunk from Fujitsu.
What about what happens next? There is a public inquiry, a big thing over the last couple of weeks about a TV drama that caught a lot of attention. What's actually happening next in the process and that compensation?
As you say, there's a police investigation, there's a public inquiry into what went wrong. There are parliamentary hearings, as we just dipped into and got some of. And interestingly, of course, the government, in reaction to the sort of public, total extraordinary public outcry at the TV drama, is saying that it's going to pass a law that essentially will say, look, we're going to bypass the courts and just declare everybody who was found guilty, we're just going to exonerate them. And we're also going to set up a sort of rapid compensation system, because, again, one of the reasons why this, I think, has just infuriated people is, you know, beyond that sort of sense that it all chimes with a broader mood of national malaise in this country, that nothing works. I mean, people were just, the public are just shocked that all these poor postmasters and mistresses, many of them still haven't been paid, haven't got compensation, and haven't been cleared.
Rob Watson reporting. Now, here's a sparkly ender to the podcast for you. Around the globe, inflation has hit many millions of households and the cost of living crisis is not yet over. But one thing at least that is coming down in price is diamonds. The De Beers company, which has massive sway in the global diamond market, is cutting prices, partly because of the current cost of living crisis. People just won't pay as much for diamonds. But there is another particular issue for De Beers. Diamonds can now be grown in labs and to a very high quality. So naturally occurring diamonds have some competition, with the supply of jewels not as constrained as it was. Well, my colleague Evan Davis spoke to the diamond specialist Jackie Larson. She came into the BBC studios here with some gems to see if one can tell the difference between the natural diamonds and those that are man-made, grown in the lab. Before that, though, Evan asked her to what extent De Beers can set the price of diamonds.
Well, I think if you're talking back to the 90s, they really were the dominant force. But in more recent times, actually, things have changed considerably. About a third of the diamond market actually comes from Russia. Hence, a lot of movement in the price. So soon after the outbreak of the Ukraine war, diamond prices really surged because I think there was a lot of concern that the supply was going to tighten up. And then more recently, they've softened considerably. But De Beers really doesn't have quite, they can't exercise that same level of control that they used to when they commanded sort of 80% or thereabouts of the market, which they just don't do now.
Now, part of the suggestion of what has been going on is that there is more competition from lab-grown diamonds. I think we should just establish what a lab-grown diamond is. I mean, diamond is pure, pure carbon, right, in a crystal form.
When you talk about a natural diamond, so one which has been mined, versus a lab-grown, so one that's been synthesized in a factory, it is still a diamond. It has the same physical and optical properties, so, of course, it behaves in exactly the same way. But the price of lab-grown has de-escalated so enormously recently. So at the last National Association of Jewelers conference, I think lab-grown were about 90% less than the value of their natural counterparts. So that's really substantial. Wow. So as a consumer, that's quite a difficult...
You can see why that might drag the price of the natural diamonds down.
But you have to understand that they are also two completely different value propositions.
And important you make that. Well, look, I think it is going to be interesting to see whether novices can possibly tell the difference between the lab-grown and the natural diamond. And I know you've got some diamonds with you.
I have.
and you have what they call a loupe, which is the little eyepiece that you can use to...
Well, you're very welcome to use this as well. So a loupe is an instrument that is almost like the first thing that we would reach for. And really all assessments of diamonds is done at 10 times magnification. So it's the thing.
These are all embedded in jewellery
So we've got a rose gold stretchy bracelet that's got some pavé set diamonds.
Jackie has just given Evan a ring, a necklace, a bracelet and some earrings. Only the earrings have lab-grown diamonds in them. The rest are all natural.
Yeah. Right. I just thought if I only brought in two, it was kind of cheating because you'd
50-50
have a
50 chance.
Exactly. I just wanted to make it a little bit more challenging for you.
Right. Just glancing at them, it's obviously not possible for me to tell. Now, I'm going to hold up. I mean, honestly...
What do you think you're looking for? And how do you feel doing this?
I think I'm looking for the sort of purity of the tilt, the angles.
What's interesting is that the quality of the lab-grown diamonds now is extremely high. The stones are of such quality that they're a beautiful colour, very clean stones.
I'm guessing the ring is lab-grown, but funnily enough, the one I thought was least interesting was the earring.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that just looks like a real diamond to me, even though it's a bit less sparkly.
The ring is about a £50,000 beautiful cushion cut natural diamond.
Okay, so
but you were right with the earring drop. The pear cut is the lab grown. But frankly, if I showed it to you next to a natural pear cut, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference either.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Well, look, the next question, and this is the really important philosophical question that comes out of this. If we can't really tell the difference, does it matter? Why don't I just buy a lab grown diamond at 10% of the price of the natural one?
Well, that would largely explain the fact that for the first time last year, over 50% of the bridal market featured lab-grown diamonds. You'd be kidding yourself if you thought it wasn't an important part of the market. It is. But I think what is essential is that consumers are very clear from a value point of view what they're getting, because there is absolutely no secondary value with a lab-grown diamond.
That was the diamond specialist Jackie Larson talking to my colleague, but not quite a diamond expert, Evan Davis. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.
On our podcast, Good Bad Billionaire, we tell the stories of billionaires and how they made their money.
Then we decide if they're good or bad.
Our latest episode is on cocaine kingpin El Chapo.
One of the biggest drug lords in history.
He's claimed personal responsibility for 2,000 murders.
Not to mention decades of violence and addiction.
After multiple escapes, he's finally locked up for life.
So, is he good or bad?
Listen to Good Bad Billionaire to find out. Nailbiter.
I mean, he's bad, right?
Yeah, but listen anyway. It's an incredible story.